Anyway, now that I've got you all in a really, really good mood, and now that you're all feeling just wonderful, let me get down to the business at hand, which is the destabilization of the Clinton administration, something, as I said earlier, that Bill Clinton has aided and abetted in a very serious fashion. A couple of details to start things on a bit of a humorous note and an incisive note at the same time. Author Edith Wharton had a quote which I think applied to the O.J. situation. I think it applies to a T to what we're seeing now. A frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys. And I think that's what we're looking at with what I have termed Wankergate in a big, big way. What we're looking at is a coup d'etat. We are looking at the complete diversion of our national attention to what, by the way, is there anybody here who gets offended by four-letter words? Because I grew up in, I spent my formative years in New York City, and they were like part of the woodwork. I noticed we have some senior citizens with us. I mean, no, really. I mean, I want to take into account everybody's sensibilities. So is there any, because, for example, if I use the full verbiage for what BJ stands for. Is that going to bother anybody?
No.
I mean, that's what we're saying. I guess, well, of course, if the Star Report didn't bother anybody, I don't think there's much of anything I'm going to say that's going to bother anybody. What we're looking at here, with the greatest financial crisis since the Great Depression bearing down on us, with Asia having collapsed, Russia having collapsed, the very optimistic petroleum production forecast for the Caspian Sea having come a cropper, with Brazil, which buys something like a fifth of all American exports, now collapsing, they're in bad shape. What are we paying attention to? We're paying attention to a blowjob. Basically. I mean, with the American Taliban, i.e. the Republican Party, leading the way. I mean, this is a farce. And again, those of us who are still around 10 years from now, remember that when the fat was in the fire, remember what people were paying attention to. And again, I think that what Edith Wharton said, a frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys. Before we get into the actual history of what is taking place now in Washington, a detail which in many ways exemplifies both the humor of this situation and the tragedy and the frivolity was made clear to me in an interview with a guy that there's a new book about the Washington sex scandals called Anatomy of a Scandal by a guy who, I believe his name is Frisk, or Fricker, anyway, but his last name begins with F, appropriately, and he was talking about Jennifer Flowers. Now, bear in mind that Bill Clinton became the front runner in the 1992 Democratic primary campaign, essentially because of the Jennifer Flowers affair. I mean, nobody had ever heard of this guy, including myself, by the way. I mean, I had heard the name, but I didn't know anything about the guy. And he emerged as the front runner largely because of his 60 Minutes appearance, in which he and Clinton and Hillary basically did a mea culpa about the Jennifer Flowers affair. I mean, Clinton admitted it, and Hillary was gracious about it. And everybody said, gosh, aren't those mature, aware, you know, contemporary people? They ought to be on Friends, you know. I mean, that's kind of how people were seeing that thing. And it's ironic that Clinton's front-runner status actually in many ways was derivative of his sexual dalliances. But the Jennifer Flowers affair has an interesting postscript. This initially was broken by the tabloids and turned out to be true. For 10 years, Jennifer Flowers and a friend and roommate had a practice of going out to bars, picking up married men and blackmailing them, which is really interesting. And what's even more interesting is that the friend, who's someone named Lauren Wright, turned out to be a he. It was a drag queen. It was initially appeared to be a woman, but it wasn't a woman at all. It was a drag queen. So Jennifer Flowers and Lauren Wright, for 10 years, were going around picking up married men and blackmailing them, which is an interesting postscript to some of this stuff. Another very, very interesting thing, and this, I think, is not at all frivolous and not at all funny, very, very serious, and I think in many ways bears out the wisdom of what Mahatma Gandhi said. One of the principles that Mahatma Gandhi held most dear, and he called his method of militant nonviolence, satyagraha, and I may be mispronouncing that. I've read it many times, but I've never heard it pronounced aloud. It's S-A-T-Y-A-G-R-A-H-A, satyagraha, or I may be mispronouncing it. My Sanskrit is non-existent, but it translates truth force. And one of the principles that Gandhi maintained was essential for viable political action was to never mix sex and politics. He said it would completely corrupt you as an individual. It would certainly destroy you politically, and it might very well destroy you sexually as well. He felt so adamant about this that he advocated strict celibacy for all of his followers and adhered to it himself. The methodology within the context, God bless you, of militant nonviolence was that in order to stand there and do what Gandhi's followers did, to face the clubs of riot policemen and the charge of cavalry, and not respond violently, to sit there and get clubbed on the skull and get arrested and not fight back and not try to injure your attacker, which is what Gandhi's followers did, and it's why they wound up beating the British. It was a tremendously impressive spectacle. I mean, the British were most brutal with Gandhi's followers, who by the thousands and thousands were clubbed on the head and trampled under the horses of mounted policemen, and yet their extreme personal restraint in the face of this violence impressed the world tremendously, because their moral superiority, their Christian with a small c, discipline and outlook, in the end triumphed. But in order to maintain that kind of extreme personal discipline, Gandhi felt it was absolutely essential to never mix sex and politics. And I would say that if ever there would be an individual who would echo the truth of what Gandhi had to say, it would be Bill Clinton at this stage of the game, because he mixed sex and politics, and it didn't work out. One of the things that's important to understand in the context of what we're seeing is that we are looking at a coup d'etat. We are in all likelihood looking at a domestic covert operation. And this is not the first one of these we have seen. I'm not going to linger on this point too long, because I've certainly spoken about it at great length on the radio. But we're beginning with the assassination of President Kennedy, running on up through Watergate, which was inextricably linked with the Kennedy assassination, on through Iran-Contra. We have an established history in the United States of domestic covert operations conducted within the borders of the United States and conducted upon the American populace, the American political populace. It's interesting that we saw in the early 90s a propaganda blitzkrieg against, quote, conspiracy theory. You know, oh, I don't believe in conspiracies, because it I think is fairly well accepted to the, at least in, within the so-called progressive community, and as always note the use of the term so-called, that our intelligence establishment for many years has destabilized foreign governments, say in the Third World in particular, in order to basically pave the way for American corporate interests, to see to it that the investment climate, as it is euphemized, is sufficiently attractive to American corporate interests, meaning basically totalitarian or authoritarian governments are put in place to keep wages low, to break up unions, and to keep environmental regulations lax so that corporate investors in those countries maximize their profits. Perhaps the archetypal covert operations in the post-World War II period were the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, who wanted to nationalize the oil companies, and the even more shocking and brutal overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, who was a free market capitalist. Arbenz was tarred as a communist by our propaganda machine in this country when he came to power in Guatemala and immediately nationalized hundreds of thousands of acres, something like 150, maybe more thousand acres of land that had belonged to United Fruit. This was basically, Guatemala was a feudal country at that time, and far from trying to turn it communist, Jacobo Arbenz was a market capitalist and was looking to bring Guatemala up into the 20th century. He wanted to turn it into a modern, market-oriented capitalist economy modeled on the United States. But that, of course, would have entailed the drastic improvement of lifestyle for the average Guatemalan, and that would have resulted in poorer profits for United Fruit, whose directorate overlapped quite heavily with the leadership of the Central Intelligence Agency, so they overthrew Arbenz. Well, if it is axiomatic to people that our national security establishment will overthrow governments and conduct covert operations abroad in order to maximize corporate profits there, I do not know why it is so resistant to some people to accept the notion that the same thing will happen here. Where are there more dollars at stake, the United States or Guatemala? Well, obviously there are more dollars at stake in the United States than in Guatemala. We have a long history of covert operations in the United States. That history, in my opinion, peaked When Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, he himself came to power as the result of a covert operation, namely the so-called October Surprise, the manipulation of the hostage crisis. And his vice president was George Bush, who, of course, had been director of the Central Intelligence Agency. One never becomes head of the CIA and leaves. And I think the age of the domestic covert operation kind of flowered, so to speak, and there's a pun there referring to the aforementioned Ms. Jennifer, peaked with the coming to power, really, of George Bush. It is my opinion that George Bush was the first five-term president of the United States, two of Reagan's, one of his own, and two of Clinton's. And by the way, I may have some very interesting news about the Tyree suit. I don't know how much I'm entitled to disclose at this time, but in about 15 minutes, I'm going to take sort of a weird break, and I'm going to try to reach Bill Tyree's attorney on the East Coast, because there are very interesting things taking place with regard to the Tyree suit. That's this lawsuit that's been filed against, among others, George Bush and the Central Intelligence Agency, and two more defendants have now been added to that suit, I understand. I'm not at liberty at this point to disclose who they are, but I think you will find it more than a little interesting under the circumstances. And also, by the way, another point I'm going to inject, remember that the KFJC fundraising marathon, which only takes place once a year, is now underway, so tomorrow I'm going to be raising funds for KFJC. But the era of the covert operation, the domestic covert operation, came to a peak under George Bush. Let's face it, you never become head of the CIA and leave. It is my opinion that George Bush literally was the first five-term president of the United States. Again, two of Reagan's, one of his own, and two of Clinton's. We're going to talk about how Clinton has been tied to the Bush apron strings, so to speak, in just a minute. I think in many ways Ronald Reagan, who was the consummate actor, found out the limitations of his dramatic abilities on March 30th, 1981, when he was shot, supposedly by John Hinckley. John Hinckley supposedly shot Reagan because he wanted to get down with Jodie Foster. Believe that if you will. I think there are other explanations that offer themselves. For one thing, John Hinckley was a member of the American Nazi Party, founded by George Lincoln Rockwell, whose Arlington, Virginia name, address, and telephone number were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest. That's Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged communist. John Hinckley had been caught at the Nashville, Tennessee airport stalking Jimmy Carter with two handguns, a pair of handcuffs, and 40-odd rounds of ammunition, and yet he was allowed to walk. That is proof that there was more to John Hinckley than meets the eye. By the way, he was kicked out of the National Socialist White People's Party, as the American Nazi Party is now known, because they suspected him of being a government agent. If you are sitting in a bar tossing down beers and you start mouthing off about how you'd love to shoot the president, you will get popped, man. You don't even want, believe me, you don't ever want to joke about something like that, because if you're overheard, it can get you into a lot of trouble. If you, any of you, were caught at an airport where the president was going to land with two guns, 40-odd rounds of ammunition, and a pair of handcuffs, you would take a long vacation. You would never see the light of day. Hinckley walked. Not only that, but the day after Hinckley allegedly shot Reagan, I actually think Hinckley was a diversion. I think that the real gunman was positioned somewhere to Reagan's left. You know, so Reagan was shot in the armpit, which is very interesting, because if he's wearing a bulletproof vest, that's where you want to shoot somebody. So it was quite something that Hinckley would have known that much for somebody who was crazy as a bleeping loon and felt that shooting the president would be a good way to get down with Jodie Foster. Of course, I believe that is nothing but a nonsense cover story. The day after the shooting, Scott Hinckley, John Hinckley's older brother, was scheduled to meet with Neil Bush, George Bush's son, to discuss a business deal in the oil business. Not only that, but John Hinckley Sr., Hinckley's father, had been one of the major primary contributors to George Bush's primary campaign. Another member of the Hinckley family was dating another member of the Bush family. Not only that, the Hinckley's defense was conducted by the Edward Bennett Williams Law Firm. That's one of the top power law firms in Washington, D.C. Among Edward Bennett Williams' other clients were John Connolly, Richard Helms, former director of the CIA, Jimmy Hoffa. I believe Robert Vesco at one point was represented by the law firm. Williams used to own at one time the Baltimore Orioles and the Washington Redskins. Very powerful individual, and he just doesn't go around representing nothing. cases. Hinckley Sr. also had been involved with a Christian missionary organization called World Vision, which at times, according to both the Christian Science Monitor and In These Times, has functioned as a CIA front, both in Southeast Asia and in Central America. In Europe, if something like this had happened, they would have understood immediately when the vice president and former director of the intelligence service is sitting behind, when basically you have a guy directly connected to the vice president and former director of the intelligence service, and he supposedly shoots the president, that's where you want to look. You want to look in the direction of the corridors of power. I am of the opinion that Ronald Reagan basically got the news at that point that he was nothing but an actor and he was not to play his part too seriously. I do believe that, and when I joked that George Bush, I wasn't really joking when I said that I believe that Bush is in all likelihood the first five-term president of the United States. We're going to see how the coup d'etat by blowjob, or what I have termed Wankergate, actually plays into that scenario. And the reason why I'm covering things which might not appear to be that central to what is going on in Washington is that I think to understand what we're really seeing, we have to understand these things in a context and a certain amount of historical depth. Something I've spoken about at considerable length and something that bears directly on this situation, that is George Bush's chairing of the Vice Presidential Task Force on Counterterrorism, because we may remember that in the early 80s and mid-80s, the battle cry of international terrorism was very much with us. You know what, I'm going to just pause ever so briefly. We have, I think, more people here than chairs. I'm wondering if I could maybe prevail on those people who are taping to either bring your deck up here or maybe hold it in some way so that people can sit down, because people have paid good money, and I hate to see them on the floor or on Zena, why don't you come up here and sit right in the front row. Same thing if we can find a chair. But these, by the way, are all the chairs that we have in the Masonic Temple, and this is also the first time we've ever sold this building out. So I want you to give yourselves a hand, really. Give yourselves a hand. Seriously, come on. Anyway, now that we've got everybody seated, and again, for those of you who are taping, you know, let me know and I'll stop so you can turn over the tape so you don't miss any of the text. And tonight's talk is being taped, and the tape will be available from Spitfire. The Vice Presidential Task Force on Combating Terrorism is very important because George Bush, former director of the CIA, chaired a task force on how to combat international terrorism. In the early 80s, for example, we were being told about Muammar Gaddafi and his death squads and his terrorist squads. Well, it turned out they were being trained by Turple and Wilson in their operation, Frank Turple and Edwin Wilson, two, quote, ex-unquote CIA agents who were conducting their arming and training of Gaddafi's terrorist cadre in conjunction with Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins, the former director and deputy director of the CIA for covert operations, under, among others, George Bush. They used active duty Green Beret to train train Gaddafi's terrorists. The materials to arm them were shipped through Jerome Brower Associates, which is a CIA front, and they shipped 20 tons of plastic explosives and some 300,000 timing devices to Gaddafi. That is a lot of plastic explosives. One of the things that's also interesting about that is the plastic explosives are very carefully monitored in this country. There is no way you're going to get your hands on a pound of the stuff and ship it out unless the powers that be want you to. You might very well be able to set up the purchase of 20 tons of plastic explosive. However, as soon as the monies have changed hands, the FBI is going to descend on you in force, and you'll go the same place you would go if you were caught stalking the president with two guns and 40 rounds of ammunition. You will go bye-bye for a long, long, long time. The point being that an awful lot of the international terrorism that was going on was being conducted by elements of our own national security establishment, including and especially those connected to George Bush, who was chairing up the Vice Presidential Task Force on Combating Terrorism. Well, recommendations came out of that task force that set up a series of interagency governmental networks, Department of Justice, Pentagon, CIA, FBI, and so forth. And representatives from each of those departments were forged into what became, in effect, a private intelligence service that was put at the disposal of George Bush. Bush had his own private intelligence service, which, even in terms of the organizational chart, was considered during the Reagan administration more important than William Casey's CIA. This is important to remember because it was under the rubric, it was under the auspices of these intergovernmental governmental agency networks that George Bush was running, that both the Iran-Contra affair and the Iraqgate affair were conducted. Not only the abuses of Iran-Contra, but also Iraqgate. Remember in particular Iraqgate, because when, as we get into, and we're about to, the actual destabilization of the Clinton administration, one of the things which has tarred Bill Clinton's administration was the Waco horror, and it was an atrocity to be sure, but the people who saw oversaw Waco were all not only holdovers from the Bush Justice Department, and Bush's last attorney general was William Barr, an ex-quote-unquote CIA officer who left the CIA at the same time that George Bush, Theodore Shackley, and Thomas Kleins did. But it's worth noting that, as we'll detail in a minute, that the people in charge of the Waco atrocity had been some of the Bush Justice Department holdovers who had been involved in the arming of Iraq. Remember that, because we're going to come back to this. And as we ruminate about Iran-Contra, and as we ruminate about the Bush administration, bear in mind that echoes of these things, as well as echoes of the distant Watergate affair, which set up the special prosecutor law, are going to be felt throughout this, because there are a number of interesting people who transcend all of these different scenarios and are to be found within each of them. Now, as I said, in 1992, Bill Clinton actually became the front runner because of the Jennifer Flowers affair, and I mean that quite literally. Bill Clinton, when governor of Arkansas, had an extramarital affair with a woman named Jennifer Flowers. This came to light. Initially, it was used to tar Bill Clinton, but then Bill Clinton and Hillary did a 60 Minutes appearance in which Clinton fessed up and said, you know, basically, oh, I did wrong, and Hillary played the good wife and understanding wife and stood by her man, as that song, the country and western song, said. And this actually propelled Bill Clinton into the front runner status for the Democratic nomination. One of the sad things about that is I think one of the very best political figures in this country was also running, and he went no place. Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, who is a really, really good man, and I think he should have gotten the Democratic nomination. And of course, he's a liberal, so he probably wouldn't have gone very far, but there'd be an awful lot of people in this country, in this world today, who'd be a hell of a lot better off if he was. And I think when the economic crunch happens, there can be a lot of people who are going to wish there was a good liberal around as they get tossed into the gutter to fend for themselves. But bear in mind that during the 1992 campaign, a number of things took place, or a number of things became apparent, which are to echo forward right to this very day. The Jennifer Flowers affair in many ways presaged the Clinton presidency. Also, we should note that during the 1992 campaign, a couple of things happened which, again, echo forward to the present time. It emerged that one of the major areas of the Contra support activity had been Mena, Arkansas, in Arkansas, specifically a Contra-related drug trafficker named Adler Barry Seal, whose plane Eugene Hassenfuss was flying when he was shot down over Nicaragua in order to precipitate the entire affair. Adler Barry Seal had been conducting a major cocaine operation through Mena, Arkansas, and Bill Clinton certainly knew about the Mena operation. It remains to be seen whether he knew about the cocaine aspect of that, but he certainly knew of and approved of and therefore was indictable for an element of the Contra support effort that was going through Mena, Arkansas, including Adler Barry Seal's drug activity. Shortly after the Iran-Contra affair broke, Adler Barry Seal, like a lot of other key drug traffickers, got shot dead. But it's worth bearing in mind that as George Bush was leaving office in 1992, and I realize I'm telescoping the Reagan-Bush years in order to get up to the Clinton years. But as George Bush was leaving office, a number of different and overlapping national security investigations were underway. Iran-Contra, the Iraqgate affair was underway, INSLAW, the Noriega situation. The Noriega situation is fascinating, by the way. The Noriega was obviously involved in the Contra support effort, was obviously involved in trafficking drugs, but doing so at the behest of the CIA and George Bush. The key witness against him, by the way, was Carlos Leder Rivas, the number two man in the Medellin cartel, who's now out of jail, and Coral Baca, the woman who was Gary Webb's source for the Dark Alliance series, is now married to Carlos Leder Rivas, interestingly enough, something that I was not aware of until recently. But as George Bush is leaving office, and the man who is taking office is Bill Clinton himself was, as the title of a book by Terry Reed and Richard Cummings says, was compromised. I am of the opinion, and I want to make it clear that I'm expressing an opinion, although it's hardly mine alone, that one of the reasons Bill Clinton was deliberately boosted into the front-runner status and why he was a made president was to see to it that the profound overlapping national security abuses that were being investigated, the abuses that had taken place during the Reagan and Bush years, abuses that George Bush had presided over, Ronald Reagan knew about them, but bear in mind that the real power behind the throne was in all likelihood George Bush. And the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affairs were conducted through the interagency governmental networks that were run by George Bush. He had his own private, extra-governmental, but intergovernmental or intragovernmental intelligence service. During the 1992 campaign, aside from the fact that the MENA connection, one of the things which I think has severely limited Bill Clinton's abilities as a president, because he basically was succeeding 12 years of outright outlaw activity on the part of not only the Reagan and Bush administrations, but the national security establishment, which underlay those. Bill Clinton, therefore, could not even begin to investigate these affairs properly. It's also worth noting that during the 1992 campaign, information was leaked concerning Bill Clinton's passport file, that it was completely illegal to do that. There was a move in Congress to set up a special prosecutor to investigate this, but a three-judge panel in Washington, D.C., an appellate court panel, headed up by Judge Sentell, who was a Reagan appointee, that's spelled S-E-N-T-E-L-L-E, nixed the special prosecutor. They saw to it that no special prosecutor was appointed to investigate the leaking of Clinton's passport file, which is blatantly illegal. Okay? Now, bear that in mind, because looking ahead, a little later, it was Judge, actually, before that time, it was Judge Sentell who overturned Oliver North's criminal conviction, and it was Judge Sentell and his panel who empowered Kenneth Starr as the Whitewater special prosecutor. I would also note that during the 1992 campaign, a very scary pattern began to become clear. That is a pattern of death around Bill Clinton. A key campaign aide named Tully died in the crash of a private plane. Another one died of a heart attack. Actually, I may be confusing that. One key campaign aide died in the crash of a private plane. Another died of an apparent heart attack. A woman who had been signing Clinton's speeches for the hearing impaired died at the age of 32 of apparently natural causes just before the inaugural address. Early months of the Clinton administration were characterized by a series of terrorist incidents. Bear in mind that Iran-Contra is still under investigation at this point. Just before leaving office, George Bush pardoned all of the key players in the Iran-Contra affair. Judge Walsh himself, in his book Firewall, has indicated in no uncertain terms. By the way, Judge Walsh is a conservative Republican. He's not by any means any sort of liberal or Democratic partisan. He was a conservative, lifelong Republican, but he's a real conservative. He's not a fascist. And he found that not only did Ronald Reagan have knowledge about the Iran-Contra affair, but that both George Bush and Ronald Reagan lied about it. George Bush maintained that he no longer could find his diaries, and yet Bush's diaries turned up at the last minute. George Bush should have been indicted. George Bush should have been impeached, but yet nothing happened to George Bush, and just before leaving office, he pardoned all of his partners in crime. Right after the inauguration, actually, you know, as I recall, it might have been right before, right at the time of Bill Clinton's inaugural address, a few days before or after, there was a very interesting shooting outside of CIA headquarters. A Pakistani national named Mir Amal Khansi, who had been a native of a town in Pakistan that had been a major staging area for the Afghan Mujahideen War, the largest covert operation of the Reagan-Bush years, shot and killed a couple of CIA officers right outside of CIA headquarters. Some people I know that are familiar with the security situation around CIA headquarters said it was absolutely impossible for a guy with an AK-47 to penetrate those security perimeters. There's something like seven of them, and they stated in no uncertain terms that it would have been impossible for somebody with an assault rifle to penetrate them, and that if by some strange quirk of fate somebody could penetrate it, they never would have gotten out of there alive. The CIA is not the gang that can't shoot straight. That is a misnomer. That is just not true. I would note that Mir Amal Khansi had have worked for the only courier service that is licensed to go inside Langley CIA headquarters. It's run by the son of former CIA officer Victor Marchetti, by the way. I would also note that according to Soldier of Fortune magazine, one of the CIA officers killed had been the case officer for one of the top arms traffickers in the arming of Iraq, which was under investigation at that very time. So a key figure in those investigations disappeared as a result of that.